From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in today for Robin Young. This is Here and Now. Workers from the steel and aluminum industries will be at the White House this afternoon, and we may learn more details about President Trump's tariffs on those metals. Here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders yesterday.
We expect that the president will sign something by the end of the week, and there are potential carve-outs for Mexico and Canada based on national security.
Well, our next guest is hoping that any carve-outs or exemptions don't just apply to certain countries. Brett Googe is an executive VP at California Steel Industries. His company imports steel slabs from Mexico, Brazil, and Japan. They heat and roll them into a finished product. And unlike many others in the steel industry, executives at California Steel say the proposed 25% tariff on steel imports would hurt them. Brett Googe of California Steel, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So let's do the math. Your company imports about 1.5 million tons of slab steel into the Port of Los Angeles every year. So a 25% tax on 1.5 million tons means what to you?
It means a lot of money. And, of course, the situation is that it'll be very difficult for us to pass that on to our customers if it does go into effect.
How much money are you talking about?
Well, I mean, if a slab costs $500, just as an example, you're talking another almost $100 on top of that, or more than $100 on top of that. You know, you're looking at a $125 increase in the price. And when you look at, we can process 400 slabs a day into sheet. It's a lot of money. And remember, that's a per ton price we're talking about. A slab weighs about 25 tons.
Yeah. And how does that trickle down to your customers? I know you make things like pipelines, for instance. What does that mean downstream?
If we absorb that cost ourselves, it's detrimental to our performance. If we pass it on to our customers, it's detrimental to theirs. Our competitors who don't import slabs and don't import steel, but may import pig iron, scrap, iron ore pellets as their feedstock, do not have any tariffs on those inputs. Mm. So they won't have the same cost problem with these tariffs that we will.
So what's your plan? Are you planning for layoffs or something else?
No, we're planning to make it work the best we can, and obviously we'll fight against the inclusion of slabs under the tariff.
Well, why are you so dependent on imported steel for these slabs? Why can't you just get them here in the United States?
Well, we're on the West Coast. We don't have a melt shop here, so we have no ability to make our own slab. So we've existed for almost 34 years on purchased slab. And the suppliers of slab in the United States are few, if any. The companies that can make those slabs are all along the Mississippi River or eastward. And they make them for their own consumption, not to sell as a commercial product on any routine basis. So we've existed on mostly imported slabs for the entire time we've been here. And again, we have to purchase them. We don't have the ability to make them.
Hmm. So let me just play devil's advocate here. If there are not very many domestic producers making steel slabs now, could this tariff by the president change that, boost the industry, provide incentives that would spur the production that you need?
We'll see. But, you know, our history shows that even in years in the past when they were operating more blast furnaces, they just weren't in the business to support a commercial slab market.
In the past few days, a lot of politicians in Washington and Oslo and also companies have been floating this idea of carve-outs. I know you're calling on the president to exclude your semi-finished steel slabs that you import and rely on. Have you been in touch with the White House? Do you feel confident that anyone would listen to you if you were?
We've had good conversations with various members of the administration. We've met with congressional offices. This has been going on ever since the president first announced that he was going to look at some sort of tariffs or quotas, and we've asked that slabs be excluded. They've heard our message, I think, loud and clear, and we'll see if they go along with that or not.
We know that the East Coast steel companies that you've referenced are in favor of these tariffs. They do something very different than what you do. Is there a tension in your industry between these big legacy companies and people like you?
Yeah, I would say there is some tension. On most things, we agree with our peers in the steel industry, regardless of the model that they have. There's a lot of things we agree on. But in this case, they will benefit by the tariffs and we will not. We've made that clear to them. We have some support within the industry and some others who would oppose our concerns.
Yeah. Brett, it seems like in a way you've been hit from a couple of different sides here. We spoke to you a little over a year ago on this program, and that was, I'm sure you remember, when the president signed an executive order that called for all pipelines in the United States to be built with domestic steel. And that was a concern for your company, just for all the reasons that we've just been discussing, because you import so much steel. It's been a year now since that executive order was made. How is that policy affecting you?
Well, it was never really implemented. I think that's all gotten rolled into this Section 232 plan. So it really hasn't affected us too much at this point. There were some concern early on among customers that they only wanted to buy domestic just in case, but that seems to have passed.
Hmm. Are you surprised now a year into this administration that you have had so many consecutive concerns with the way he's treated your business and your industry?
Well, surprise is one word, I guess. It's been a challenge. But at the end of the day, we're still standing, and we plan to still stand.
Yeah. That's Brett Googe with California Steel. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, much of the East Coast is digging out after a winter storm that led to more than 3,000 flight cancellations since yesterday and has left more than a million people without power. It was the second nor'easter in less than a week. For more, we're joined by the Weather Channel's Maria La Rosa. Maria, which region got hit the worst?
Well, there are a couple ways to measure that. If you're talking strictly snow, there were plenty of places in New England. Woodford, Vermont got 36 inches. New Fairfield, Connecticut, 26.8 inches. Pretty remarkable, though, with Central Park getting only 3.2 inches. So still impactful, but not quite the snow story there.
Well, and here where I am in Boston, we were seeing in the forecast that it was going to be rain. And then all of a sudden you wake up and there are 8 inches of snow on the ground.
That was one of the calling cards of this storm, sort of a forecaster's dream slash nightmare, because it had such a sharp cutoff where you could go literally a couple miles and go from no snow to maybe a foot and a half. A great example is Central Park, where they got 3.2, and then you had North Caldwell, New Jersey, 16 miles away. They got 23 inches of snow. It was just the way that storm and that rain snow line set up.
And is it over at this point, the storm?
It's still producing snow, gusty winds from New Hampshire to Maine. Maine has a few more hours to pick up some of that snow, especially northern Maine. But for the most part, it is definitely winding down.
Now, this comes not long after that really big nor'easter that brought a lot of flooding to many places. Was this storm very different from that storm?
There were a few key differences, strength being one of them. That last nor'easter got down to 974 millibars, one way to measure the strength of the low pressure of the storm. This one, 986, and doesn't sound like a big difference, but that difference in strength of pressure made a huge difference with the winds. And so that was one standout. Of course, with that last storm, you had Barnstable, Massachusetts, with a 93-mile-per-hour wind gust. We didn't see anywhere near that with this one. Another difference was that this storm was moving along. So it didn't just sit out in the Atlantic and spin and churn up the waves and push the water on shore. So you didn't see the level of coastal flooding that you saw with that last nor'easter.
In the case of this storm, we're seeing a lot of people without power. Talk about the impacts of this storm.
What makes it so difficult to deal with is that you are coming so close to that last nor'easter. So people who are just getting power back on probably got knocked out again with this one. And those without power who lost it with the first one, they're going on almost a week now, right? So along with that trouble to deal with that, you have crews who are still battling some of these elements. We have still winds that are gusting 20 to 30 miles per hour with this. That makes it difficult for these crews to get out there and fix those power lines, which again adds, insult to injury for those without power. The good news, if there is a silver lining, is we don't have this big Arctic chill behind it. Temperatures today in a lot of these places are not only above freezing, but probably closing in on 40 degrees like in Boston. So that will help for sure.
And thank goodness we are almost done with winter, at least officially. As you look back on this winter, how would you describe it? Was it a mild winter? Was it a rough winter?
I think if you had a pain index, it would be off the charts, because while it may not have been overall brutally cold, you know, we had the big chill in the east in January, it was just a lot of impactful storms, whether it was the rain or the freezing rain or the snow. And once you get in a pattern, you get one after the other. And so I think it's been a tough, painful winter for a lot of people, whether it was flooding in the Mississippi Valley or the nor'easters in the east.
That's Maria La Rosa of the Weather Channel. Maria, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Today is International Women's Day, and there are celebrations around the world. In London, there's a panel and debate on women in tech. In Abu Dhabi, there's an international women's art exhibition. And in New York City, fashion icon Diane von Furstenberg is holding 4 days of panels and discussions on the theme Women in Charge. She joins us now as part of our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top. Diane von Furstenberg, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And what does International Women's Day mean to you in 2018?
Well, first of all, International Women's Day is something that I have celebrated all my life, because in Europe we, you know, it's a celebration. You get these beautiful yellow mimosa flowers. But this year I went a little further and decided to extend the celebration in 5 days. And so we actually started last night. And we have a series of panels and meetings and in order to give voice to all kinds of women. And I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Do you feel that women are under attack right now?
Women are under attack. No, I would say at this point that women have decided that, you know, enough is enough. And clearly, you know, I've always been a feminist. So for me, I was so happy to see that it became, you know, it came back into fashion, so to speak. And I'm very, because, you know, I was a feminist in the 70s, but then my children's generation, somehow they took it a little bit for granted. But now I see for my granddaughters, they are not taking it for granted, and they are very activists. And I think that this year the genie came out of the bottle and will stay out.
At the same time, you look at something like President Trump's cabinet, and it's got the lowest percentage of non-white men and women than any president since Ronald Reagan. Do you think that that makes a difference?
I mean, I think anything we see in that cabinet is just, I mean, if anything, women should be proud that they're not there. Hmm.
What about in Fortune 500 companies? Just 5% of the CEOs of those companies are women.
I know. But I do believe this will change. And I do believe that, you know, women are, I mean, for example, even in Hollywood, you know, Reese Witherspoon or Kerry Washington, they have production company, they hire women, everything. So, yes, I mean, it's still not fair, and yet men are beginning to worry, you know, who will protect them. So it's just, you know, we have to look for more equality. We have to look for, you know, equal wages. I mean, we just have to. I mean, it's not an option.
What are you hoping to specifically accomplish with this multi-day focus on women?
It's really about having women and girls talk of all different backgrounds with all different issues, talk and discuss, and we're all live streaming it on the Facebook Live, so it should be very interesting.
And is the audience, I mean, do you want women to hear all of these conversations, or is it important for men to hear them as well?
Well, of course, men should listen to it too. But what I like about when you get women together it's they speak differently and they talk differently, and there's a networking that happens, and that's always very good because, you know, one woman meets another woman, and then it's very inspiring, and they network and they get to know each other, and then they get to help each other, and so I always find that very inspiring.
Who was the woman who most inspired you?
Well, my mother, clearly. I mean, my mother was a young girl of 22 when she was arrested in occupied Belgium and was shipped to concentration camps. She spent 13 months between Auschwitz and Ravensbrück and another camp. And when she was finally found at the end of the war, she weighed 49 pounds. And so, you know, she survived, and soon later she got married, and she wasn't supposed to have a child, and then I was born. And she always taught me that, you know, fear is not an option, and no matter what happens to you, you should never be a victim. So I am a fruit of a survivor who never wanted to be a victim.
How did you manage to do that, to go from being the child of a Holocaust survivor to having the empire that you have now?
Well, I mean, the big question is how my mother survived. You know, how I survived was nothing compared to that. But I guess it has to do with, you know, with being your best friend, being in charge of your destiny, you know, and just living your life fully and driving your car and not taking necessarily no for answer and just design your life. And that's what my mother taught me, and that's what I did.
Do you see yourself now as a role model for other women?
I think every woman is a role model for other women when she's willing to be honest and sincere and talk about not only her successes, but also her challenges, her vulnerability, and her fears.
You and your brand have been part of the fashion world for over 40 years. What do you think is the biggest change that you've seen from when you began?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the big change in today's world and what is disrupting everything is clearly the digital revolution, you know, and that's what changes everything, and that's what changed the way you sell and you buy and you live, and so that has changed everything.
And for the better or for the worse?
Well, I mean, you know, it is. So you just have to apply with it and take the good of it. And, you know, and it's, you don't look back. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. You don't go against progress. So you just, you know, try to understand the disruption and surf the tsunami and go on it.
You're, of course, very famous for your jersey wrap dress, which you introduced in 1974, and it became a staple for millions of women. Does it still give you a thrill to see somebody wearing it?
Well, it's very funny. You know, for years, I almost resented it that my name always came up with a wrap dress. Mm. And then 40 years later, 4 years ago, when I actually had a big exhibition at LACMA, and I celebrated its 40th birthday, and the entire museum was all about wrap dress. That day I decided, okay, all right, I accept it, and that will be, you know. And it's funny because people always say that, you know, I created the wrap dress, but in a sense, it's the wrap dress that created me.
Huh. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's you know, I had no idea when I did that dress that it would, you know, change my life and so many other people's life. I had no idea. You don't know when you do something, you know, how important or not important it may be. And that little dress allowed me to be the woman I wanted to be and pay my bills and be in charge. And because it was a dress, I would, you know, I communicated my confidence to other women with that dress. So the dress became the vehicle of becoming confident, not just for me, but for a generation, many generations of women. So it's, you know, the dress, decided to have a life on its own, in a sense.
Do you ever wear clothes just for comfort, like a T-shirt and sweats?
Yes, but the wrap dress is completely comfortable. I mean, that is one of its big value, is that, you know, it doesn't wrinkle, it doesn't get old, it doesn't... I mean, it's totally sustainable. Like, you know, the 40-year-old dress sells at on eBay at the same price as the one today. So, but yes, for me, it's all about comfort. If you're not comfortable, you can't look good.
I have to ask you one more question while we have you. And you've been involved with so many causes over the years, but one that has been so great for so many people is you were a big part of the High Line Park on the west side of Manhattan, which transformed this elevated rail line into this beautiful, walkable park.
And it has become the number one tourist destination.
Wow.
In New York. It's I still, to this day, when I walk it, I cannot believe that we made it happen, because it was supposed to be destroyed. The destruction paper had already been signed by Mayor Giuliani, and somehow we turned it around and managed to realize this dream of creating a green ribbon that goes from Gansevoort all the way to Javits Center, and I'm very proud of it.
You think it should go even further?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, just the fact that it happens, it's so beautiful and makes so many people happy, and you're suspended. It's very nice when you walk all these blocks suspended at that height.
Yeah.
It's just magical.
That's legendary designer Diane von Furstenberg talking with us there about the High Line in New York, but also about International Women's Day, which is today. Diane von Furstenberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and congratulations to all women today.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
An impromptu spring training camp for unsigned Major League Baseball players will close up shop tomorrow in Florida. The Players Union formed Camp Jobless to give athletes without a team somewhere to get ready for the upcoming season. That's because there's been an unusual number of unsigned players this offseason, including some of the best talent in baseball, and accusations of collusion are starting to fly. Mike Pesca is here and now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, I've been getting ready for baseball, watching spring training every year since I was like 6 years old. I have never heard of anything like Camp Jobless.
Camp Jobless. They make it sound like a Works Progress Administration funded entity, right? These poor, bedraggled hobos just looking for some soup and an honest day's work. It is true that it is surprising that many of the top free agents in the game are unsigned. I should say, many of them were recently signed. Jake Arrieta, who won the Cy Young Award in 2015, he is by far the biggest high-profile free agent who isn't signed. But at this point, compared to other seasons, very good Major League Baseball players aren't getting the contracts that we think that they should deserve and that they would have gotten in past years. There's a few reasons for that. The players say collusion is one. Mm-hmm. I don't know. No collusion. Maybe that goes too far, but
it spread to baseball. Oh my god!
Yeah, I would. There's a lot of factors, and one of them is that there are a bunch of teams who really aren't that interested in winning this year, for instance, and that's why the players' union have sued baseball, saying that four of the teams, most notoriously among them the Marlins, are just more incentivized to lose, hopefully get better in the future, but collect some revenue by the revenue share. sharing scheme rather than just to put the best products on the field, and this depresses the free agent market a little.
Yeah. So I mean, it's interesting because you know, we're about to get ready for this season is about to start. You know, how many players are still out there? Who does
well,
it apply
depending,
to?
Well, depending of the players who it would be very surprising if they wouldn't be on a team. There's, you know, a dozen or so, and then there are guys who are, you know, flitting in and out of the major leagues. I mentioned Jake Arrieta. Now, Lance Lynn's a very good pitcher, or certainly a very serviceable pitcher who's not been signed, and Alex Cobb. These aren't household names, but these are guys that you put at the number three or four, definitely five spot in the rotation, and they get you wins. It's you pay them a few million. You might pay them $10, $12 million a year, and they wind up being worth it. The other thing that's happened is that other free agents like J.D. Martinez and Eric Hosmer thought they'd get bigger, better contracts, and they didn't. And one of the reasons, a couple reasons that we talked about some of them, but one of the reasons is that a lot of these guys have a very hard negotiating agent, Scott Boras,
right,
and he holds out for the most money. And the other thing is, let's look at the horizon. It's going to be one of the best free agent classes ever next year.
Mm.
So Manny Machado coming on the market, Bryce Harper, and the clubs are saying, why spend all this money on a Lance Lynn? Why not try to make a big swing for Manny Machado?
Mike, quickly, are we headed for labor dispute?
We're always headed for labor dispute, but I also think we're headed for an exciting year in baseball, and someone's going to sign Jake Arrieta, and I think he'll be a good pitcher again because he always has been.
All right, here and now sports analyst Mike Pesca. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration has quietly lifted an Obama-era ban on importing trophies of elephants from some African countries. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service made a first attempt at this about 3 months ago, but changed course after President Trump personally intervened. Joining us now is Vicky Croak, who covers all things animal for us. Hi, Vicky.
Hey, Jeremy.
So there's been some back and forth on this, but what changed?
Well, the fast, if somewhat opaque, answer to that is that one court decision has triggered this forward movement and in a direction that the president himself has spoken out against in strong, even disparaging terms in the very recent past. But the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals made a ruling in December, this in response to a long-running lawsuit brought by the NRA and a hunting group, Safari Club International. The court ruled that the Obama administration did not follow some of the procedural rules, one specifically making sure to allow public comment before implementing the original regulation on the ban of these imports back in 2014.
So this court decision is what led to the reversal of the ban?
Right. So U.S. Fish and Wildlife, which is overseen by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, issued a letter dated March 1 saying it will start allowing imports of these trophies as well as those of lions and a type of antelope. All of this involves six African countries: South Africa, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Tanzania, Botswana, and Namibia. And these permissions will be approved on a case-by-case basis.
Case-by-case basis. So how will that work?
Individual permits, we're parsing the information. The criteria are not spelled out. There are established rules involved in this kind of import of the remains of animals protected under the Endangered Species Act. The rules require that the hunting of the animal involved has to enhance the survival of the species. But one of the concerns of conservationists is that the process for granting these permits to individuals might make the decisions less transparent. Elephants are still considered a threatened species. Poaching for their tusks has slashed their numbers. We know that their population in Africa has been reduced by about 30% in just one seven-year period from 2007 to 2014.
Wow. Now, some big-game hunters argue that hunting elephants actually aids in conservation efforts because hunters pay a lot of money to get the permits that they need for this, and that money goes to helping communities advance conservation. Is that a fair argument?
Well, that's one view. Certainly hunters can spend tens of thousands of dollars in their quest for an elephant or a lion. But even looking at this strictly as a financial transaction, and many people do not, there are questions about regulations within some of these countries about whether those hunting costs really make it into conservation, if the hunting meets the standard required, or if money reaches and supports local communities who live with wildlife. I've reported on elephant issues for so long.
Right.
I've known a few elephants, and I've written a book about an astonishing group of Asian elephants in Burma, Myanmar, in World War II. These are incredibly intelligent, deep-feeling animals who are willing to risk their own lives to save one another, to feed a family member who's sick or injured. We know that each elephant is a unique individual and that the loss of one has meaning to those they're bonded to. The death of certain elephants, a matriarch, for instance, will erase an archive of survival wisdom and have long-term effects on the safety of the family. Obviously, conservation groups, animal welfare organizations, and animal rights advocates are vehemently against the change.
Well, and it sounds like President Trump at least used to be. Let's listen to him talking with Piers Morgan in January.
I didn't want elephants killed and stuffed and have the tusks brought back into this. And people can talk all they want about preservation and all of the things that they're saying, where money goes toward. Well, money was going, in that case, going to a government, which was probably taking the money.
So it sounds like he was against this idea. What about Ryan Zinke, the Interior Secretary? He's a big hunter.
That's right. And Donald Trump's sons, who have been on big game hunts, also have been pictured in the social media storms around this. In fact, Donald Jr. famously is seen in one photo in 2011 holding the severed tail of a dead elephant. So President Trump, in that original tweet back in November, said, "Big game trophy decision will be announced next week, but will be very hard-pressed to change my mind that this horror show in any way helps conservation of elephants or any other animal." So did the president change his mind? His press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, says his position on trophy hunting remains the same today, but it's unclear if he'll intervene.
I was just at an elephant sanctuary recently in Laos, and you learn about how threatened they are, and it just makes you wonder why people are still hunting elephants.
You know, Jeremy, this is the very, very heart of the debate, and you experienced it in person, and I'm really glad that people are asking that question.
That's Vicky Croke, our guide to the animal world. Vicky, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, to wild horses and burros now in this country, there are too many of them on western rangeland, according to the federal government. The Bureau of Land Management says the land has to support native wildlife and cattle grazing, and the horses and burros can deplete needed vegetation. So far, the main strategy to control the population has been roundups, corralling the animals and taking them to large ranches to live, all at government expense. But researchers hope to shift to another strategy, birth control. From member station KJZZ, Brett Jaspers reports from northwest Arizona.
Grace Kaler spots a wild Jenny, a female burro, with her binoculars.
Well, she's just a typical gray burro. Ooh. You look pretty young. You got thick stripes on your right side.
Kaler's in the Black Mountain Herd Management Area in northwest Arizona.
As soon as she turns just a little bit more, 017. So she is a control.
Part of the control group in a research study. Kaler works at the Humane Society. Together, researchers and government officials are trying to find the most cost-effective way to dart wild burros with PZP. It's a vaccine that causes infertility for about a year. If a vaccination program can work in a vast open rangeland like the Black Mountain area, it could save taxpayers millions of dollars. Every day, Kaler goes out in her gray pickup wearing a hunter orange baseball cap. She looks for burros, sets traps for them, and visits a small group waiting for release. She may dart a burro with PZP, but it takes time to get close enough for that.
Sit, wait, you know, once they're comfortable with you, move another 10 yards. Maybe 10 yards was too much, so now you got to move back 5 yards, and then you got to wait for them to acclimate to you again.
The important thing is that the animals are accessible enough to dart with a dart projector.
Stephanie Boyles Griffin is a scientist with the Humane Society. She says PZP works biologically. That's not up for debate.
What we're trying to do is actually figure out in a real life situation how we would use this vaccine in order to stabilize and reduce herd growth over time.
Slowing herd growth can't happen soon enough. The Bureau of Land Management is trying to keep the number of animals on the range below a certain number, the number it says the land can sustain without serious damage to the ecosystem. Euthanizing horses and burros is illegal, so is selling them to slaughter. People aren't adopting enough animals either. That leaves rounding up horses and burros and holding them on ranches. This costs tens of millions of dollars each year, and the BLM still isn't below its target population number. PZP has long been mentioned as a solution, but getting a program going also costs money. David Phillips is the author of the recent book, Wild Horse Country.
Just like an addict can't afford to go to rehab because they're spending all their money on drugs, the BLM can't afford to get serious about PZP because it's spending all its money rounding up horses.
There are some wild horse herds kept in check with PZP in other states. Volunteer groups do a lot of the tracking and darting with BLM oversight and training. But these are typically smaller herds, and the animals are less skittish around humans. John Hall is the BLM's lead in Arizona, working on wild horses and burros. He says he has less and less money and staff each year to do field work and start long-term research projects. With the Humane Society study, they can now get the information they need. Whether Washington will act on the results, Hall couldn't say.
Obviously, if we get favorable results, then our state leadership here will absolutely support us trying to move forward with some sort of program. But it's always hard to say.
At a large corral in the Black Mountain area, dozens of wild burros keep their distance from the approaching humans. Grace Kaler tosses in light green alfalfa.
It's very moving to see wild animals being wild and seeing them in the groups that they're supposed to be in and having normal behaviors where, you know, they stay away from you, they're not interested in you.
Keeping wild burros in the wild would be ideal, Kaler says, even if it requires birth control to preserve the ecosystem and reduce animal roundups. For Here and Now, I'm Brett Jaspers.
The annual meeting of China's legislature is underway in Beijing. There's a lot on the agenda at the National Party Congress, but much of it has been overshadowed by last week's news that senior Communist Party officials had abolished presidential term limits, allowing President Xi Jinping to hold on to power indefinitely. NPR's Anthony Kuhn has been following this story. He's based in Beijing. Anthony, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
The National People's Congress is expected to take up this issue of term limits over the weekend. Is it essentially just a rubber stamp at this point?
Yes, in the sense that it basically never vetoes or rejects a law that the party and the government put before it. But the Chinese context is that the leaders of the country have to work very hard to make sure there are not a lot of no votes or abstentions. If there are, it's an embarrassment. But anyways, Sunday they will vote on these constitutional amendments, which could essentially give President Xi Jinping the presidency for life, and as there's not much suspense, they are expected to pass. So in that sense, yes, it will be a bit of a rubber stamp.
Is there any dissent, though? And if there is, will it really ever be heard?
There is some dissent among liberal intellectuals. This is an issue that has really sort of dominated China for the past century. And it's only been a century, basically, since they got rid of the last dynasty and have been under what they say is a republic. And so they really feel that, you know, history has got to move in the direction of democracy and modernization. And when they feel it's moving backward, it's really a terrible feeling for people. And a lot of people are just outraged that it seems to be moving backwards.
Yeah.
But, you know, social media and the press here are very heavily censored.
Search terms have been banned throughout the course of all this.
That's right. All sorts of obscure jokes and references to this, like synonyms for ascending the throne and a meme involving Winnie the Pooh, which some people think looks a little bit like Xi Jinping, have been banned. So you don't see a lot of public dissent.
Now, obviously, as we've just been talking about, China is not a democracy, but we have seen across the globe populist candidates and parties emerge in places like the United States. We just saw it in Italy in that election over the weekend, in France. Have we seen anything like this at all? Any populist insurgency sort of bubbling under the surface in China?
I don't think we can say it's a populist insurgency. What's similar is that people like a sort of self-styled political strongman, and they feel that he's, getting more done than his predecessors, who were a bit ineffectual. But I don't think it's quite the revolt we saw before. There's also, you know, an element of an appeal to nationalism. Definitely there is an appeal to the idea of making China great again, by which they're referring to, you know, centuries ago when China was basically, in their opinion, at the center of the civilized world. So there is that.
Well, there are many other issues on the agenda at this conference, as we've mentioned. Talk about the economy. China's domestic debt, which is growing. I know that's going to be a topic of conversation.
Yes, they're very focused on reducing particularly local government debt, financial risks to the system. They've been cracking down on a lot of big enterprises that have been investing money in the U.S. And other places. They're afraid of, you know, financial meltdowns. They're afraid of capital flight. So tackling financial risk is a huge task. Corporate and local government debt are a very big part of it as well.
And they'll be talking about something else, pollution. I understand pollution has been falling in Beijing and other northern cities in China, according to Greenpeace. You live in Beijing. Have you noticed that?
Well, I've certainly been hacking and spluttering less. I mean, it's the best winter we've had in about a decade. And, you know, it's really interesting that this ties in very closely to the Trump administration's proposal to hit Chinese steel with tariffs. Well, the Chinese government actually wants to shut down a lot of steel factories precisely because they pollute so much. So they're just like lopping off millions of tons of steel production capacity. And so in that sense, you know, the Trump tariffs will actually help them to close down some of these factories because there's a glut of Chinese steel anyway. Everybody knows that.
But on the issue of the tariffs, Beijing's foreign minister said it would make a necessary response to President Trump's tariffs. Politically speaking, how is the threat of a trade war going over there?
Well, yes, you know, China cannot be seen to be weak or pushed around by the U.S., but they're not really making a huge issue out of it. And I think it is because it would help them. As I said, it partially is because they're trying to cut their own steel producing capacity. But also, you know, this issue has set the U.S. and the EU and the U.S. and its neighbors against each other. It's driven a wedge between them. And that helps China by keeping them from ganging up together against China.
All right. NPR's Beijing correspondent Anthony Kuhn. Anthony, thank you.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.